Good evening, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. This is your host, Lance White. By the way, I loved tonight's Dawn and Wind show. You guys were very funny, very entertaining, very intuitive. And I want to wish Dawn a happy 11th anniversary and many more. Before I introduce tonight's guest, I'd like to take a moment to wish my friend Joy a wonderful and happy birthday. Enjoy your evening with Bernie Joy. And while I'm spreading so much love around, I might as well say hello to another friend and a former guest, Helen Luttrell, who wrote a wonderful book called Rachel's Eyes. This kind of segues into tonight's guest because it's a similar topic. It's there's a lot about abductions going on and connection with ETs and other world beings. And my guest tonight is Anne Andrews. Anne has written a book entitled Walking Between Worlds, Belonging to None. Her story focuses on her son, Jason, who is a long-term abductee and an indigo star child. Alien abduction typically runs in families, and Anne Andrews came from a long line of abductees. Although it wasn't until her son's experiences accelerated that she began having dreams and was given back long-hidden memories, which enabled her to accept and cope with what was going on with her youngest son, Jason. Anne lives in England, so she's kindly agreed to stay up into the wee hours to be with us tonight. So let's welcome Anne from this other world over the seas, if she's on now. Anne, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Hi, Anne. How are you tonight?
I'm very well, thank you. I've got a little bit of a cold, I must warn you, but
oh.
Other than that, I'm fine.
Well, we'll muffle through it. How's that?
That's great.
Thanks so much for staying up late to be on the show. I didn't realize until just before the show that it's 3 o'clock in the morning there, isn't it?
That's correct, yes.
Oh, thanks so much, Anne. I really appreciate it.
That's right. It's a pleasure.
I loved your book, by the way. And,
thank you.
I think for our listeners, so that we can all kind of get clued in on what's happening, can you just start at the beginning and tell us what your book is about and what inspired you to write it.
Yes, of course. It's called Walking Between Worlds, Belonging to None. It's basically about us as a family. That's myself, my husband Paul, our two boys, Daniel and Jason. And it's, it's about our journey. It centers around our youngest son, Jason, and just after he was born, we now understand that he was being abducted by ETs. And so that the book sort of, you know, chronicles our journeys, our understandings, and how basically we went from an initial standpoint of fear and confusion to where we all are now, which is a lot more understanding. We're a lot more spiritual, a lot more aware. And as I say, initially we were very frightened, but now, you know, we accept it as part of our lives. And I think, you know, the whole experience has been good.
When did Jason first start having trouble?
That would be just after he was born. When we came back from the hospital, after a few weeks, we put him in his own room, in his cot, and during the night and the day, we would hear him crying, you know, occasionally. We would go into his room, and a few times we would find him not in his cot at all. He was always in the room. Sometimes he was underneath the cot, sometimes behind a door. As I say, always in the room, but we couldn't work out what was happening, what was going on.
Huh.
So for the sake of, I suppose, rationality, you know, we worked out that if our oldest son, Daniel, who was 4 at the time, we worked out that maybe if he stood on a chair and maybe if he stood on tiptoes, he might be able to reach the baby.
Huh.
So, as I say, you know, because of, obviously thinking rationally, we said, well, that's got to be the answer. It must be. You know, it must be Daniel that's moving him.
Uh-huh.
But so there were times when Daniel wasn't even in the house. He was staying at his grandmother's or something, and it would still happen. But,
uh-huh.
You know, we just well, we wouldn't even sort of face those times.
How long did this kind of thing occur? Well, how long did it happen before you began to actually move from denial and justifying what it was to starting to actually consider that it might be something metaphysical or otherworldly?
Truthfully, Lance, that took us 12 years
Wow.
to actually come to that conclusion.
Wow.
An awful long time. I mean, during that time, we actually sort of subjected Jason to all sorts of medical clinical tests.
Uh-huh.
We took him to see child behaviorists, specialists, psychiatrists. And truthfully, all we ever got from the psychiatrist was a letter to us and to our GP stating that he is not psychotic.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the thing that he'd been telling us since he was able to talk, and his story never ever changed, the psychiatrist said that is the truth. He's telling you the truth.
Wow. And when he started talking, how old was he, and what when did he start talking about the visitors, and what did he say?
Well, basically, he used to, about sort of 2.5, 3, when toddler just starts to, starts to understand and put sentences together.
Mm-hmm.
He would run into our bedroom some nights, absolutely terrified.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tell us that the little men had come for him.
Mm-hmm.
He would tell us that they come up through the floor, they come through the walls, the windows. He said he described them as what he called little people with very big eyes.
Mm-hmm.
He said that there was always a bigger one, a taller one with them that looked very much the same. And he would say that they would make him very still so that he couldn't move. And then he said that they would make him fly, and they would take him to what he called a hospital place.
Mm-hmm.
Where they would do tests on him and this which at times are very painful, but he associated it with that was like a hospital place.
Mm-hmm. Were there any people there that he recognized as being from Earth as well, or were they all from another like Greys or the small little people?
Truthfully, when he was young, he couldn't get over the terror, couldn't get over the fear. I mean, we put it down each time to, we just said, well, he's having nightmares, this is what's happening, this is what's going on. It wasn't until, as I said, when he got to the age of 12 that we were actually sort of given an insight into what was actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was at that point when we actually started to really believe him. I mean, we were always there for him in the sense that all parents are there for their children, mm-hmm. To hug them, tell them that they're safe and everything's fine. But we just couldn't believe what he was telling us, which
mm-hmm.
is why obviously we put it down to nightmares. But it was at the point where we did start to say, look, we believe you. We know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point that he started to listen to them and to start learning and to start understanding because I suppose at that time he had our support. And it changed everything for him,
mm-hmm.
because he was sort of listening and understanding what was going on. That I suppose that was the time that he started to sort of look around and notice other things. And yes, there were quite a few times when he did see other people, other human people.
Uh-huh. What are some of the other things that you started to notice about that time in his life, like starting around 12?
I suppose the highlight would have been on his fourth birthday.
Uh-huh.
I say highlight, but that was a really strange thing.
Uh-huh.
which began on his fourth birthday.
Okay.
It was his first ever birthday party, so obviously he was extremely excited by it all. And it was when the party was over that, you know, myself and Paul, my husband, and my mum, who'd come over for the day, we were all clearing up, you know, all the children had gone. Daniel was in his bed. Jason had fallen asleep on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a thunderstorm just starting outside. It was, you know, heavy rain. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And then suddenly there was a very heavy knocking at the door, which obviously we thought was very strange at that time. Paul answered the door, but there was nobody there, so he closed the door again. And then suddenly there was this sort of big bolt of lightning, at which point Jason sort of sat bolt upright on the couch and started just coming out with incredible numbers, you know, just sort of, I suppose, in computer fashion, you know, coming out with all these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But the knocking started again, but this time it wasn't just the door, it was all over the house, it was upstairs, out the back, on the windows. It sounded like, you know, there was an army sort of, you just banging on the house.
Wow.
And then suddenly it died down again, and Jason stood up and started walking towards the door. And my husband sort of put his hands on his shoulders and just sort of gently said to him, "Where are you going, boy? It's pouring down, you know, you're going to get soaked." And without even looking at him, you know, Jason just said, "I have to go, they're waiting for me."
Huh.
Which was quite chilling, as you can imagine.
Yeah,
And at that point, you know, the banging sort of increased in severity. It got really, really loud.
Wow.
And then, of course, my husband, sort of not knowing what else to do, and because all of us were really frightened, he just picked him up and sort of just held him really tight, held him close, you know, and I said, "What's going on? You know, like, we don't understand." And at which point, Jason seemed to sort of come out of his trance-like state, and as he did so, the knocking receded. And then, of course, he just looked at his dad and said, "Oh, I'm up late. Can I watch telly?" And you know, so he wasn't even aware that anything had gone on.
Wow! Wow, that's amazing.
So,
when did Jason begin to not be afraid of them and understand his relationship? And did they explain to him in any way or communicate telepathically why they were doing this?
Yes, he's explained that to us, which, as I said, the turning point for him was just after he was 12.
Okay.
Because that was the point at which we got the psychiatrist's letters, and we didn't really know which way to turn. And it was a TV program about hypnosis that we were watching, which sort of gave us, you know, the obviously pointed us in the right direction. But to say that is all documented in the book. But it was at that point that we started sort of saying, well, you know, this is real. This is actually happening. You know,
uh-huh.
it's happening to our son.
Mm-hmm.
And we started reading, you know, looking into this more in an effort to obviously be there for him in every way that we possibly could.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's like even now, if you say to Jason, you know, "What is it in all of this, Jason, that sticks in your memory?" You know, he will always say, "It was the day my mum and dad said that they believed me." Because, as he says, it changed everything for him. You know, he began to not be so terrified because mm-hmm. he knew that he had our total support. And that's when he started listening. And they actually explained to him that they were only doing what they were doing because they were waking him up to, you know, the reality of who he really is.
Oh. That kind of ties into the concept of him being an indigo child and a star child. Can you explain what an indigo child is and how you discovered that Jason was one?
Yes, I'll explain it to you as I understand
it. Okay.
It's my understanding that a star child or an indigo child, I believe that they are the same thing.
Mm.
They're born to parents where either both or one of whom is an abductee, whether they know it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they carry the ET, part of the ET gene, if that's if you can understand that. it's almost like they know that they don't belong here on this planet. You know, that they know that they come from elsewhere, from somewhere else out there in space somewhere. But they're extremely, extremely intelligent. Not in the ways that we would expect, like, you know, reading and writing, you know, the things that our values. But you know, they're basically here to help us, you know, to help us to understand our part in everything, and to help us, you know, to become aware of our own sort of spirituality, our own consciousness, and that is what the Indigo children are here for, and they are gathering in numbers.
It's quite a phenomenon, the Indigo children, and now I believe there are crystal children and even rainbow children. And I've heard that the names for those kids have to do with the color of their aura, that the first wave of Indigos came through actually as long as 100 years ago, and that there are adult Indigos. Probably many people in the audience are adult Indigos, or their children are Indigos. And it has to do with the color of their aura being indigo. Does Jason have any abilities that are beyond the normal that you're aware of?
Yes, he does. And as you rightly say, people that can see auras have told us that Jason's aura is a very dark blue indigo.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, he has certain psychic abilities.
Mm-hmm.
He can astrally travel and astrally project. And this we have got proof of.
Mm-hmm.
And also he is a very gifted healer.
Hmm. Is he aware of where humanity might be headed in the near future?
He says that there are quite a few possibilities. You know, when we asked him about this sort of thing, you know, he says, well, nothing is ever written in stone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he also says, you know, this is why human race is interesting to us. He always sort of counts himself, you know, as part of them.
Uh-huh.
He always says, this is why humans are interesting to us,
huh.
Because you know, because you have free choice. He said,
huh.
You make your own decisions. He said that this is what makes you interesting, you know, because you have free will.
Huh.
He said, in a way, it's interesting to see, you know, exactly what you will do. You know, in other words, which way you will, you know, you will head.
Hmm. That kind of infers that the ETs and the beings from that density do not have free will.
It does, actually, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that before. What I was going to ask you was, you mentioned that often the child that's been abducted quite frequently has one parent or the other who has also been abducted. You had some experiences as well, didn't you? And they came back through hypnosis?
That's correct. Yes, they did. And it appears that I've had you know, quite a few experiences, which I've managed to sort of keep well hidden.
Is there anything that you can tell us about your own experiences that you either remember or have spoken of in your sessions of hypnosis?
Yes, I can tell you, you know, obviously very briefly of a couple. One being when I remember very, very clearly, and that this wasn't through hypnosis, this was a very clear memory of when I was about 7 or 8.
Uh-huh.
I remember waking up in my bed, not being able to sleep, so I went into my mum's room.
Uh-huh.
And asked if I could sleep with her, because I just felt very afraid. My dad was working nights, so, you know, of course she said, yes, come on, you know, you can get in here. And still not being able to sleep, I distinctly remember, you know when you get that feeling that you know somebody is there, I remember sort of like, you know, peeping over the bedclothes.
Mm-hmm.
To see a hooded figure, just almost like float around the side of the bed, and then I'm sort of gazing at it, you know, and terrified, and I couldn't wake my mum. She wouldn't wake up, and the family dog was asleep at the bottom of the bed as well, and you know, he wouldn't wait.
Mm.
And I just remember the sort of, you know, long fingers going up to this hood to push it back. And that was the only memory I had for many, many years.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't until I started sort of, you know, getting some of my own memories back through hypnosis and other means that I was able to sort of remember how that progressed.
Uh-huh.
But it's interesting because I remember sort of the next morning still being terrified and trying to tell my mum about it.
Mm.
And, you know, I remember to this day, you know, her sort of sitting me down and giving me a cuddle and saying, look, you know, you've had a nightmare. That's all it is. You've had a nightmare.
Right.
And, of course, many years later, you know, there we were again, same scenario, saying the same thing to our son.
Uh-huh.
But so that was one. And there was another time when I was with my dad. My dad was a full Romany, and you know, he used to like nothing more than, you know, taking me for like these long walks in our local parks. And I remember walking with him in the park one day when we were suddenly confronted by some very, well, what I thought that at the time were very tanned people, you know, that they had a lovely sort of suntan.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that clearly because I thought, well, you know, aren't they lucky to be able to afford to, you know, go abroad for their holiday? Because obviously in those days that would have been a big thing.
Uh-huh.
And I remember just sort of standing and nobody said anything. My dad, I believe he knew them, but he was surprised to see them there, but, mm. you know, not shocked because he knew them. And then it was like, suddenly, you know, I was holding my dad's hand, and then I just became aware, I don't know how, but I just suddenly became aware that we weren't in the park anymore. You know, I couldn't see the sun, and we weren't standing on the grass, and I don't know how we got there, but we were on some sort of big sort of metallic sort of hallway-like room.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always remember, you know, one of them stepping forward, and almost if he noticed me, and then it's like his eyes, you know, you couldn't sort of break away from his gaze.
Mm-hmm.
And he just sort of reached down and took my hand and just sort of started walking me away from my dad and the other people. And it was like, you know, the only thing I could think of was, well, you know, what's going on? Because my dad's always told me never to talk to strangers and don't go with strangers. And yet he's letting them, you know, why is he letting them? And
mm-hmm.
And this very human-looking man, but with very large blue eyes, he took me to this room, and the door opened, and it was a very noisy room because there were lots of children, and they all had toys to play with, and you know, building bricks, and you know, all the sort of things that young children, you know, like to play, all different ages, and he let go of my hand, so. You know, that there I was just in this room, and he left, and then this young boy sort of came over to me, and for some reason I knew him.
Hmm.
You know, we knew each other, and instantly I knew that he was deaf. I don't know how, but I knew that he was deaf, and, you know, we just sort of, you know, grabbed each other's hands and just went off and, you know, just started playing with the toys.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, that was my sort of memory of that experience.
Wow. And was it your impression or feeling that the beings that were with you at that time were benevolent?
Yes, most definitely. I didn't see or hear anything that would have, you know, sort of told me otherwise.
Uh-huh.
At least I felt very comfortable. Obviously, at first I was very frightened because, as I say, you know, there was this stranger taking me away from my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, why is he standing there? Why is he letting him, you know? But,
mm-hmm.
But as I say, once, you know, I got into the room and recognized the boy and, you know, he recognized me and we were playing. It was all forgotten and it was, you know, it was a real nice feeling to be back there because, mm-hmm. then I knew that I'd been there so many mm-hmm. times. Everything was so familiar.
Wow. Now, this kind of leads me into a question about the possibility, since Jason is part of this whole process, and you've been part of the process. We know that it's been said that these beings are using humanity or humans for breeding purposes as well, and we don't know why that might be happening, but apparently it seems to be benevolent from what you're saying. Is it possible that Jason's DNA or his birth was altered in some way, or I believe he might have even actually been a walk-in as well. Is that true?
That's correct. Yes, we weren't even aware of any of this until his 18th birthday.
Oh, okay.
It was like when I was expecting Jason, you know, the doctors were extremely worried about, you know, the health of the baby and obviously myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until you know the baby was actually being born that you know the emergency room sort of, you know, erupted into sort of action. And I mean, at the time, my husband, who was with me, was told you know to possibly expect you know, for the child to be stillborn, because they sort of put on a fetal monitor and, you know, other equipment, but they weren't registering any sort of heartbeat, which was extremely worrying. So, of course, then the race was on, you know, to get the baby born and, you know, for them to do what they could. But, of course, when Jason was born, he was extremely healthy, very, very noisy, and that hasn't changed much, but... you know, he was a perfectly normal, healthy baby, which, I mean, totally surprised the staff, but, you know, everybody was absolutely delighted. And then, you know, the staff said to us, oh, well, you know, obviously the machine is faulty. You know, we'll get that taken care of. But it wasn't, as I say, until his 18th birthday, because we were getting ready for his party and, you know, expecting all his friends to turn up. And he came and sat us down and said, you know, oh, I'll make you a cup of tea, which, you know, we thought, oh, something's coming. You know, he never does that. And that's when he explained to us that he had chosen us to be his parents because he knew that we would understand in time. You know, we would come to understand just exactly what was going on. And he said that he knew that the baby that I was carrying would be born dead, and he said that he had to wait until the instant that the baby's soul or essence or energy actually departed from the child. He said, and at that moment, he said, at that sort of split second, he said, that is when I walked in.
Wow.
He said, because he said, I wanted to experience what it was like to be human again. He said, and also he said, I thought, if I get to understand, you know, humans better, he said, when the time comes, he said, I'll be in a better position to help and to do what I can.
Wow.
Which was a bit of a revelation.
That's
to
chilling.
Say the least, but
that's chilling. That's chilling. That's such an absorbing story that it just completely threw me off. I was right there with you at the birth, and you know, I've spoken to other people who've written books about pre-incarnational contracts and people agreeing, you know, to do this and that before they incarnate. And to actually hear somebody talk about, you know, the soul leaving in one split second and the other one moving into it, is just, and to be aware of that is such an amazing phenomenon. I mean, it's just really quite special. So with time, it appears that he became more aware of who he was and why he incarnated. So apparently all of his fear and all that was something that he had to go through, because he chose to be born into your family.
That's correct, yes.
Now, what insights have you gained since then, and what is he doing today? I mean, what does he have a purpose, or is he, you know, is he here to change the world? Is he in communication with other Indigo kids, since they're telepathic? What do you know about that?
Yes, he tells me that he is in communication with a lot of the Indigo or Star children. He says that he does a lot of his work when he travels astrally.
Okay.
He also says that part of his work is to attend like accidents or, you know, this sort of thing where he said he actually helps the he calls it the essence. He helps the soul to move on.
Wow.
You know, to realize that their physical body is gone and just to move on.
Uh-huh.
He said that is all part of his work. He does a lot of his healing work when he does his sort of astrally as well.
Wow.
But he said he is here basically as are all the other indigos who are here and who are arriving to help us to help us all to become more aware of becoming what we all once were, what we once had. He said because we were all able at one time to use all of our brain. We all had the power of telekinesis, telepathy. He said it was all there. He said it was all there, for you. Everybody could do it. It wasn't it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't only certain people that could do it. He said you could all do it.
Wow.
He said you also were very, very spiritual. Not in any religious sense at all, but just in. He said you've lost it. He said you've lost that connection. He said you've not. He said you've got to start realizing again, that you are all connected to each other. We're all part of each other. He said, and we're all connected to the planet, which again is a living thing. It's a living energy.
Uh-huh.
He said once you understand, that you're part of that, you're part of that consciousness. He said. You can just sort of do anything, the world is your oyster.
Wow, that's such a beautiful. I just am deeply moved by that message. Does he seem to feel that all of us as a whole, or the Earth as a planet, as a living entity, is headed towards some sort of shift in consciousness? Or, is that a possibility? We talk about that a lot on our show, about 2012 and so on. Does he ever speak about dates or prophecies of the Mayan calendar or anything like that? Or is he beyond all that?
Yeah, we have asked him quite a few times about 2012, and he just says to us, "Well, it's a number." And we say, "Well, yes, but surely you've heard all the theories about 2012 and the Mayan calendar." And he said, "Yes, but it's a number." He said because he said technically time doesn't exist.
Yeah,
he said it's something that humans have invented. He said to make them feel more in control. He said that. He said, in another sense, he said, you are talking about the end of one time and the beginning of another.
Yeah.
He called it like a world shift. He said, things are going to happen. He said, but he said it can go sort of, down, quite a few different paths. He said that this is why there are so many indigos and star children here now, he said, to help you. He said, if you can get over your own sort of, arrogance, really, is the way he put it.
Yeah.
He said to acknowledge, these children that they do know more than, say adults, and will be able to sort of help you and guide you.
Mm-hmm.
He said because he said that there is just one rule. He said, and that is that we can never ever interfere. He said, we can advise, we can assist, we can help, we can do whatever you ask of us.
Uh-huh.
He said, but he said, we can never make it happen. He said, because he said, again, that's got to be your choice. You've got to decide which path you're going to go down.
Uh-huh.
He said, and once you start down it, he said, that's going to be down to humanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does he have awareness of why we lost all of our abilities? Some people refer to that as the fall from grace, or the fall of, from higher densities to lower densities, and some say that we were, placed in a frequency control, and so on and so forth. And of course, everybody's heard about the theories that there are negative polarity entities which are, you know, trying to use us for their energy and purposes. Does he say why we fell, you know, why did we become disconnected from our spirit and the telekinesis and the powers that we've had in the past? And does he ever explain that?
Yes, I believe he has done. Again, you know, we've sort of questioned him about all this sort of thing. And he said to us that, yes, you know, like I said to you before, humankind did have all of these things that, you know, this stuff is a sort of considered special for now. He said, but he relates it to going back to the time of Atlantis. And he says that he said that they will never find any evidence of Atlantis. He said because he said Atlantis was the world. He said it wasn't, you know, a group. He said it wasn't a race of people like the Sumerians or Babylonians. He said it was. The world had got to the stage of, you know, everybody was part of Atlantis. He said that was main, you know, most of the world. And then he went on to explain that, you know, basically because of everything that we had, he said we got lazy. He said we got bored, and then we started sort of, you know, going back to sort of making things, you know, making machines, this sort of thing. He said at first it was just for pleasure, just for fun, for something to do. He said it became more and more intense, and then it was, you know, sort of certain people started sort of taking over and saying, well, you know, we need to sort of make weapons because, you know, this side might attack us or they might do something, so we need to be ready. And he said it's basically, he said you've got to the stage that you're getting to now. He said at that time, he said you had it all. He said you had everything.
Wow.
He said, but he said, you know, so he said it was your greed again that, you know, got the better of you, he said. And he said it's happened so many times.
Really? And again, it seems that history is repeating itself, and here we are, you know, creating a empire with weapons and, you know, secret black operations and underground facilities and so on and so forth. Speaking of that, that kind of brings up the question about the concept that certain governments might actually be working with some alien races. Did you discover anything about that issue?
Yes. Again, this is something that we discussed, and he's explained to me. He said, "Look," he said, "the way it is on this planet," he said, "is that, you know, you've got good people, you've got bad people." He said that is the balance. He said, and he said that balance is maintained. He said, "Wherever you go in the universe," he said, "you will always find the balance of good and evil, basically." He said it's no different out there. He said of all the races that visit this planet, he said some come, you know, so with your, you know, with your future, you know, in their mind. He said some are benevolent. They're here to help, to do what they can. He said, but he said that you also get visited by the, well, as he calls them, the not so good guys. He said because he said that there is always a balance, and he said yes. He said quite a few of our military personnel, our governments, are working with certain ETs, certain races. He said, and he said although they think that, you know, they're in control, they're in charge. He said, you know, so that they will get a rude awakening.
Yes. I can understand that one.
Yeah.
Do you, because of his connection with some of these beings, are you monitored by certain government groups? Are you kept? Do they keep an eye on you, do you think, or are you pretty much lead a normal life?
Basically, we lead a normal life. I suppose you would say. Okay. I mean, we have sort of so much sort of paranormal stuff going on around us at certain times, but, you know, so if you overlook that, then yeah, we're just normal people, and that's how I would always describe myself. I'm just the normal person who sometimes has to endure sort of abnormal things, basically. But, you know, having said that, I mean, we know that, we are watched, you know, that there have been a few incidents with our telephones. And also, especially sort of late at night, you know, if we get up to use the bathroom, we will sometimes notice a light sort of coming through the window. And then, of course, you know, your first thought is, well, look out the window to see what's going on. And it's car headlights. So, in other words, you know, there's a car sort of being parked in our driveway, waiting for someone to switch on a light in the house, so that they can then sort of shine their lights to let us know that they're there. Which is, you know, it's rather bizarre. And then, of course, the car sort of then starts up and drives away sort of very slowly, you know, to say, like, you know, we are here, we're watching you. And we've had that a few times. We've also had an incident where, sorry, have I got time, Lance, or am I badly not?
No.
Hello?
Hello, are you there?
Oh, sorry, yes, I am.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, all right, okay. Yeah, just saying, are we all right for time, or?
No, we're fine, we have 15 more minutes.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, well, I was just going to explain what one of the experiences we had.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
What it was, I was woken up one morning, you know, that the phone rang, and it was a lady who lives in one of the houses at the very beginning of the road where we live. And she said to me, she said, you know, Mrs. Andrews, because, you know, I didn't know her. She got my name from the phone book. And she went on to tell me that during the night they'd had an intruder in their garage, you know, herself and her husband. And she said, we went into the garage and my husband put the lights on, you know, and he went in sort of armed with a baseball bat and I followed him. She said, there was this very well-dressed man, she said, it looked to be in his 30-something. She said, dark suit, dark tie, you know, she was very smart, very clean cut. She said he just looked at us and grinned, she said, and then carried on sort of, you know, like rummaging through, you know, our stuff. Like, you know, we had some boxes in there. She said, even when my husband told him to stop and, you know, leave things alone, she said, he just looked up and looked at us and said, you know, I want to speak to Anne Andrews. And of course, at that time, you know, they didn't know me. So of course, the husband said, "We don't know anybody by that name." And he just grinned and he said, "Are you sure?" And they said, "Yes." And he carried on rummaging. The wife went to phone the police, and she came back to the garage and said to her husband, "The police will be here, you know, in a few minutes. You know, that they said they'll try and keep him here." And the guy took no notice at all. He carried on rummaging. And then she said, literally about a minute before the police arrived, she said he just put everything down and just smiled at them again and then said, "Oh, I have to go now." And she said he just came towards us and just pushed past us. She said, we moved out of the way, she said. And she said, for the life of me, I don't know why, she said. But she said he never touched us or did anything. She said, but she said, we were so frightened of him. And she said, we followed him outside, she said, thinking, well, we'll get the number of his car, you know, we'll get the registration and give it to the police. She said, but she said, he just walked out into the middle of the fields, you know, just disappeared into the darkness.
Really?
And she said it was the exact same time that the police arrived. So, of course, she went through the story and said that they'd asked for me, et cetera, et cetera. And her phone call that morning was obviously to tell me what happened and to ask if the police had been in touch. And, of course, I said, no, I hadn't heard anything. So she asked me to phone the police and said that she would do the same and try and get to the bottom of it because, obviously, I said that I didn't know who the guy was. And we did. We both phoned the police. I was put through to about four different departments. And then in the end, I spoke to, I think, some senior officer. And he just said to me, oh, yes, don't worry about that. It's all been sorted. So I said, well, you know, I'd like to know what it was all about. And he said, well, you don't need to know. It's been sorted. So, you know, which is a very, very strange thing.
Yeah.
And then she said to me, well, why didn't he just look up our phone number in the phone book the same way that she had done? So
Great.
You know, I really don't know what to make of that. You know, sort of people saying, oh, Men in Black, you know.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like.
I don't know. I really don't. That's a real strange one.
Wow. Is Jason still being in contact with these aliens?
Yes, most definitely.
And does he actually go onto the ships, or is it just telepathic, or what?
He does both. He tells us that he sees them now as equals. You know, he calls them his friends. He believes that, you know, that they're all equal. But he says that, you know, he's contacted all the time, and vice versa. He can contact them, telepathically.
Uh-huh.
He does visit the ships, sort of, you know, every so often. And, you know, I think the bottom line is he does enjoy his relationship with them.
Wow. Well, what's one of the more interesting things that you've probably had all the same questions that any of us would have had, you know, like what's going on, why are they here, what are they doing, and what's happening? What's some of the most interesting information that you discovered from your own questions to him?
That's a good one.
Well, like, why are they doing this would be a good place to start. You know, the abductions,
right.
and you kind of touched onto it already, but I just wanted to see if we could find out anything more to dig a little bit deeper into are they doing this all across the globe? Does he know, you know, is it an isolated event? Is it common?
What, the abductions?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he said it's a global thing.
Okay.
He said that there are a number of reasons why abductions occur. He said not all abductions are alien abduction. Some of them are performed by military.
Really?
But he said in the main part, just speaking, you know, strictly, you know, from the ET side, he said... One of the main reasons is that because of all the weaponry and everything that you know, the capabilities that we have now, he said there is, you know, like a fear in the universe that if we explode this planet, obviously it would have sort of far-reaching consequences,
uh-huh.
You know, throughout the galaxy. It would have like a knock-on effect, as it were. You know, it could sort of destroy other things.
Uh-huh.
You know, he said some of the abductions are to measure the toxic,
toxicity?
Like the poison levels, you know, in the air, and in what we do. He said it's how they measure sort of, you know, what we're doing to the planet, what we're doing with you know, chemicals, this sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
He said it's all sort of, you know, measures, he said, basically to keep an eye on what, you know, what humans are doing, you know, what we're getting up to, I suppose. He said we are sort of worried about, you know, what you're up to, basically.
Does he ever talk about global warming or chemtrails?
Yes, he says they're not a good thing. You know, the global warming, is mainly sort of, you know, down to us because of all the pollution that we're putting out there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, something interesting that he did say as well, which was that, you know, he said that most of the technology that we have now, he said that we wouldn't have access to it if it wasn't for certain races of ET.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, well, you know, how do you work that out? You know, how can you justify that? And he said, well, if you think about it, he said, do you not think it's really strange the way, you know, sort of technology has come on in leaps and bounds in the last 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
He said, because he said prior to like the 1950s, he said it was a very, very slow sort of progression, he said, which is how it should have been. He said, but then he said, suddenly you go from, you know, sort of like in the last 50 years, you know, he said, you're up to, well, the technology that we have now, he said, which, he said, you know, he said, I'm sure you, he said, if you think about it, he said, that's sort of speeded up tenfold, he said, and, you know, so he said, that, don't think that, you know, so you're all responsible for it, he said, because you're not. So, you know, there again, I suppose, that sort of, you know, worry about what we're going to do with this technology, and I suppose in another way, I suppose, you know, perhaps they feel partly responsible.
Because he's an indigo child and he has had all these different experiences, would you have any words of advice for other parents who have indigo children, and what would you recommend for them to, you know, what would you say to those people, to the parents?
Right. What I would say is that the main reason for writing our book is because we hope that, you know, if it helps just one family understand, you know, what is happening to their child, then it is worth it.
Yeah.
Because we spent 12 years, you know, denying any possible, you know, anything to do with you know, ETs, UFOs. To us, you know, our social upbringing was such that it just did not exist. It would not be allowed to exist. It didn't happen. Therefore, it couldn't be anything to do with that. As I said, you know, we took our son to so many sort of so-called experts thinking they'll have the answer. And I mean, I'm not suggesting, please, you know, please don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that every child that has a nightmare is being abducted, because that's ludicrous. But all I would say to anybody out there who, you know,
hello,
and is, listen to them. You know, just please listen to them, and be there for them.
Yeah. We're coming to the end of the hour, and I notice our connection is starting to go bad. Maybe the aliens are interfering with us, or the government is.
Somebody is, yes.
You know, that's a long way to string a wire between two cans. So maybe my tin can is falling apart here. But before we go, would you tell people where they could find your book, and do you have a website or anything as well, or?
I don't have a website,
okay.
But that's my fault because I don't know how to set one up, but I will one day get someone to do it for me. but yes, if anybody wants to buy the book, it is available on Amazon.
Right.
That's Amazon.com. And also there will shortly be a DVD will be coming out with an interview with Jason, you know, which will accompany the book. So.
Oh, wow.
You know. Yeah.
If that's wonderful. If you had to just kind of say in one sentence what Jason's message might be for our audience and for the world, what would that be?
I know what he'd say. He'd say, you know, it's time for you to wake up. It's time for you to realize, you know, your true potential and to be all that you can be.
Wow.